Listen to me. It ain't nothing but a heartbreaker. I got one friend that's the Undertaker.
Welcome and thanks for listening to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining us, we're listening to Jack Abramoff, once the most influential lobbyist in Washington, D.C. He talks about lobbying industry and power with Aliza Newland Carney. Jack Abramoff was convicted in 2008 of mail fraud and conspiracy. He was at the heart of an extensive corruption investigation that led to the conviction of White House officials J. Stephen Grills and David Sabanin, U.S. Representative Bob Ney, and nine other lobbyists and congressional aides. He served 3 years, 6 months of a six-year sentence in a federal prison before being released early to a Baltimore halfway house in June 8, 2010. And now on to Jack Abramoff.
You do say, looking back, you should have been bothered by how often staff members whom you asked for help returned with requests for political contributions. And now reform advocates say the solution is public financing. Do you agree?
I don't agree. First of all, I don't trust any government program, to be honest with you. First of all, I had the privilege of living under the government auspices for 43 months. So I got up close and personal with a lot of government employees, and I'm not certain I want them running too much, although they treated me all right, you know, at the end in the place. I'm nervous about public financing for a lot of reasons. First of all, the Jeffersonian reason of not taking somebody's money and spending it on an ideological thing that they don't believe in, which I think is ultimately philosophically a problem there. Second of all, we're at a time where we need to cut back the government, not increase the government expenditures. And third of all, whenever you open up a government program where you're spending money, guess who shows up ultimately? The lobbyists. Somebody's going to show up and try to get control of that money. That is human nature. I would much rather see a total bar on the people whose money in the system is sullying the system. See, I don't view it that somebody who's out there who just cares about the country and wants to give away all their money to politics because that's what they like, I don't view that as a problem. If they're not asking for things, and if it's revealed and disclosed who they are, if they're not asking for anything, they're just giving their money because they believe in people, I think that's good. I think that's what this country should have been. I'm not in favor of people who are like I was, who was giving money and raising money to get something. That is the problem. And I don't think campaign public financing, it certainly sort of addresses that, but to me it creates a different problem, a different potential for corruption that I don't want to see.
Many are angry at Washington right now, both on the left and the right. Do you think they have a right to be? And
absolutely.
Should Congress respond?
Well, they should wake up, for openers. They have a 9% approval rating. That should tell them something right there. But you rarely hear them even worry about that. They have these things like the insider trading laws, and they don't understand why they're so unpopular. They don't understand that people look at them, and they look at what they're doing, and they look at the money they make and the power they wield over everybody's lives, and they resent it. And we don't have a monarchy in this country, but we certainly have something close in terms of the Congress and to some degree the White House.
You recommend that government lawmakers sign a cleanup of the government pledge, not unlike Grover Norquist's anti-tax pledge. Why?
Well, it's effective. Whether one supports the pledge that Americans for Tax Reform facilitated for members to sign or not, nobody can deny it's effective. Now, I don't believe that Republicans aren't raising taxes only because of Grover's pledge. People forget that not raising taxes is a primary tenet of the Republican Party. What he's done, though, is concretize it into an actual pledge so that if somebody breaks that to their constituents and to their voters, they can hold them accountable. And what I propose is a similar thing with good government. Let's come up with changes that are going to fix the system, and let's demand of our legislators and those who are running for these seats that they sign this pledge, that they're going to vote for, they're going to co-sponsor, and they're going to do everything they can to push through legislation that enacts these kind of changes and, frankly, takes away their perquisites in terms of this life both in Congress and afterwards, and hold them to it. And if they don't do it, kick them out.
You describe having met Grover Norquist as a college Republican, I believe Ralph Reed as well.
Right.
Describe what the role that these two men played in your life and the role they play now.
Well, Grover and I met. He was a student at Harvard Business School. I was a student at Brandeis. I had just become the head of the College Republicans up there, and Grover was active in the organization. And together we organized Massachusetts for the Reagan campaign in 1980 and worked very hard and had all sorts of adventures and hijinks I wrote about in the book, some of which were pretty funny. And basically, at the end of it, we won Massachusetts as a group, everybody who was involved, but they were kind enough and generous enough, the party, to credit us, that we provided the difference. We registered, several thousand absentee balloted college Republicans whose votes at the end of the day made the difference in a 3,000 or 4,000 vote victory in that state. So Grover and I went through that together. After that, Grover suggested to me to run for national chairman of College Republicans. He had had some involvement with Karl Rove and others of the past and were friends with them. I didn't know anybody. I'd just come out of California and went to Brandeis. And so Grover was my campaign manager, and then when I won in 1981, came as my executive director and stayed with me through that year before he went off to do other stuff. He returned with me. We reunited under President Reagan's lobby, where he was the field director. And then he went off to found Americans for Tax Reform, which has been immensely effective. Grover and I haven't been in touch much during this. Grover's, unfortunately for him, had tremendous scrutiny all quarters. People seem to get mad at him over the tax thing and blame him for the budget super committee business. And so he tries to, I think, keep his head down a little bit. And so we've not had much contact, but I consider him to be a friend, and I haven't been in touch with him, but that's okay. He's got other battles to fight.
What about Ralph Reed?
Ralph came to the convention I was elected at in 1981 as a very young man, a teenager, and came to work for us, lived in my apartment on the couch. We couldn't afford to pay more than $100 a month. In those days, we had no money. Grover, a Harvard MBA, was making $1,000 a month, and I was making $1,000 a month as well. And Ralph got $100 a month, so he lived on my couch. He became executive director, eventually had a religious epiphany, and went off to then work for Pat Robertson, ultimately at Christian Coalition, built the organization into an incredible operation. Ralph played a role in our efforts to stop casinos in the South. His depiction of his role caused him trouble later, as he didn't necessarily describe things precisely correctly, and it wound up probably costing him a lieutenant governor's race. I haven't been in touch with Ralph since then.
At the very beginning of this book, you describe how your trek to a Senate hearing felt like a death march. And I want you to talk a little bit about the series of events that began in 2003 after articles in the Washington Post began to appear that questioned the amount of money the tribes were paying you, raised questions about your involvement in a casino cruise line business venture known as Sand Cruz that fell apart under questionable circumstances. That was the beginning of a whole chain of events that you describe, which are almost sort of archetypal Washington crisis and unfolding of a scandal where you're under this microscope and, you were fired from your lobbying firm, you were investigated by federal prosecutors, you were called to testify on Capitol Hill, you were pilloried by the news media. What was all that like for you?
It was horrible. At first, when it started, as I mentioned, I thought this would probably blow over after a couple of weeks. I didn't think there was anything to it. The article in the Washington Post, which came out at the beginning of March, I guess, in 2004, or end of February, the article said I charged my clients a lot of money. There were articles on the front page of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal that said the same thing. Yes, I did charge my clients a lot of money. This reporter who came to see me for the Washington Post, I gave her an interview. Tried to explain to her what we did for our clients. There wasn't much interest in hearing that. So the information that I compiled didn't get in the article. But when the article first came out, frankly, there was an email back and forth with the firm saying, should we post the article on our website? All it really does is talk about how, you know, it's claiming we're ripping off our clients, but our clients know better than that. And what do we, you know, it'll be over with soon. But then Senator McCain got into action and subpoenaed all my emails and started a serious investigation from the Senate side. Unfortunately, it seems this investigation involved some of my rival lobbyists. He actually wrote a letter to the chief of one of the tribes lauding the work of one of my rival lobbyists in the investigation. So it seemed to me that at first that it would go away, and then when it was clear it wasn't going to go away, I thought, well, gosh, why am I getting picked on here? What's this all about? I'm just doing what everybody does, right? Oh, why is this a problem? Shortly thereafter, obviously, quickly, I was fired by my law firm, and people started to, you know, treat me with a little bit of disdain or a lot of disdain. And there were more articles. It seemed like every day brought an article on the front page of the Post. It was extremely difficult, as you can imagine, for my family, and seeing the paper get there every day, and there I am on the front page of it. And eventually, I started to look into. I hired an attorney. I had a brilliant attorney named Abby Lowell, who started going through with me my emails and all of what I'd written. I wrote 850,000 emails over the less than a decade that I was a lobbyist, so I kind of had diarrhea of the fingers, and there were plenty of emails there, and Senator McCain's committee was sort of parsing through them to find those that were boneheaded and salacious and things like that, and knocking them out to the Washington Post and the front page. We complained. We filed a complaint to the Senate Ethics Committee because that violates Senate ethics. If you're having an investigation, you're not supposed to leak it all to the press, but they didn't quite pay attention to that one. And so eventually it became clear to me that I had crossed lines, and lines that I didn't set out to cross, lines that I didn't think I crossed when I was doing it. Frankly, I stopped caring about the lines, to be honest with you, while I was lobbying. I just wanted to win. And I didn't understand what this was all about. And then eventually I started figuring out what it was all about, and I saw that I had done things that were wrong. And when I did, it shocked me, to be honest with you. I didn't contemplate that I would ever have a moment like that. And then while I'm sort of going through this personal journey of figuring out what I did and where I was, there was a public inquisition going on. And everything in my life was taken negatively. Every aspect of my life, even the charity we did, was described in pejorative terms. And so I eventually saw different papers who, like the LA Times, where I'd grown up and out there in Beverly Hills, they had to have their cut at me. And so they went back and took my eighth grade election when I ran for president of the class in the eighth grade, and they recharacterized that as if this was the beginning of my nefarious campaign activities. And they had another article where when I played football, I hit a linebacker once pretty hard and knocked him out, and they portrayed that as proof that I was some kind of villain, you know, as if you're supposed to play football, I guess you're not supposed to hit people according to them or something, I don't know. But anyway, this was going on, and I was sinking, and I just kept falling and falling and wondering, oh, when does it stop? But it never stopped, and it kept going and going. It stopped when I landed with a thud in prison. I was brought up to that hearing you asked about, and I described the first part of the book. And I pled the fifth at the hearing. It's because Senate hearings, people ask me, why'd you plead the fifth? Senate hearings aren't sort of fair fora for judicial rights. The witnesses don't have rights in the Senate. In fact, they have rules in the Senate, they don't even abide by them. I'll give you an example. When we got there, the first thing out of my attorney's mouth, Abby Lowell, sat down and he said, you know, senators, I'd like to ask a question, a point of information. And they recognized him. And he said, you have a rule that you made that if a Senate hearing is likely to lead to the indictment, criminal indictment of a witness, or the besmirching of their reputation, this hearing has got to be in held in closed session. That's your rule. Now, if there's a hearing that is more likely to lead to an indictment of somebody or destroying their reputation than this one, I can't imagine what it is. But meanwhile, you have this hearing in the biggest room on Capitol Hill. You designed it to take place when they were opening the Native American Museum, so you could fill the room with people who have been whipped up against me. And you have more cameras here than the Super Bowl, and this hearing should be closed. And the senators kind of looked at each other, looked at him, kind of chuckled, and kept going. So I knew that there wasn't going to be a fair for him. But what kind of got to me while they were asking me questions was the memories coming back to me of who these guys were. you know, a lot of them were people who either I or people who worked for me gave a lot of money to. Byron Dorgan got $75,000 from people who worked for me or my clients. Senator Campbell, who chaired the committee, claims he doesn't remember it now, but I read in the book the exact date of it. We had a breakfast at La Colleen Restaurant, which doesn't exist anymore, where I handed him a bunch of checks. He was chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee, and he told me that our clients would do very well in front of his committee. And so I'm thinking these things as I'm watching these senators ask me these horrific questions, insulting, nasty questions, and I'm pleading the fifth over every one of them. And it got so bad that Senator McCain, who was my greatest antagonist, actually was the one who stepped forward and said, "Senators, I think we better stop this. We're actually harassing this witness." No kidding. And so they stopped, and I got to leave. But it was a horrific experience, as unfortunately this whole thing has been.
One of the things that seems to really stick in your mind was the way in which you were pilloried for wearing a hat. The image of you wearing a hat as you exited, I believe, that hearing.
No, it was when I pled guilty in court.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was January 2006, and I knew from the beginning I was going to plead, because as soon as I saw I was guilty of things, I didn't want to fight and create a big spectacle and drag things out. I wanted to get through it, and I wanted to do what I thought would be right. So I knew I was going to plead, and I was already cooperating and meeting with the Justice Department, as I did do for many, many days, including after I went to prison. And the day came in January 4th, I think it was, maybe 6th of 2006, when I had to go to court. Now, everywhere I went, the media would show up with their cameras, and they'd charge me and yell things at me and make it as unpleasant as life can be. And I really didn't want that, so I decided to go to court as early in the morning as possible to beat the media. It was, I think, a hearing at noon or 11 or something, and I went at 6 in the morning. And it was raining, and it was dark when I left that house that January morning. So it's raining, so I grabbed the raincoat and I grabbed a rain hat. People said it was some Borsellino or some fancy hat. It was a rain hat, a collapsible rain hat that I had in my closet, and I grabbed it and I put it on. And I walked in the rain and went into court. And then most people had raincoats on who were going in. There weren't a lot of people going in at 6 in the morning, but folks who were, including my attorney, had raincoats on. And, well, the hearing took place. I pled guilty. I had a lot of things on my mind that day, not my wardrobe. And I walked out. I put my hat and coat on to leave, and as I walked out to the glare of the sun and to the glare of the cameras, they start screaming at you. Now, the folks who are taking pictures, they scream terrible stuff at you. And the reason they do that is they want you to look at them. All right, so that they scream something more outrageous than the other guy, they figure you'll turn around and look at them, and that's the goal. Well, they were screaming stuff at me. They said, "Who are you, a gangster? Are you a mafia?" And first, I didn't know what they were talking about, and then I realized that the hat, and I wanted to say, "What are you talking about? The last gangster wore a hat like this was George Raft in the 40s, but I didn't get to say anything. And I realized at that point I had a wardrobe malfunction, and I had set myself up, unfortunately, for a real problem. But that's what happened, and I write about it in the book, and unfortunately that has sort of become the image of me that played right into the image of Boris Badenoff, the bad guy, the mafiosi, and things like that. And unfortunately in life, sometimes innocent things, if you don't think about them, they can redound to your detriment, and that certainly did.
Do you think that you were treated fairly?
Well, by whom? A lot of people treated me. So.
Well, by federal prosecutors?
Yes, I do. I do. They sent me away to jail for a long time. But I thought they were incredibly professional, very thorough, above reproach, and treated me with great dignity in the sense of they were professional. I didn't experience what some people experience with prosecutors, which is kind of harassment and prosecutorial abuse. The people who worked on my case that I experienced were nothing but professionals, and I appreciated them greatly being professional. It was a horrific thing. I knew eventually that I was going to end up in prison, and the prosecutorial team and the Justice Department were obviously the ones who put me there. I put myself there, I guess, but they were the ones who were the operating side of it. But even knowing that, instead of looking at them and hating them, as frankly most prisoners and felons hate their prosecutors and their judge and even their lawyers, and certainly the FBI, I don't hate anybody. I put myself where I went, and I regret it.
You describe pacing the track at the Cumberland Correctional Facility and going over how could we change the system, what would you perform, what would you recommend as reforms. What was the hardest thing about being in prison, and what lessons, if any, did you take away from your trial and imprisonment?
Well, I took so many lessons away. Unless we have another hour, I'm not going to be able to go through all of them. But some of the big ones were that you got to follow the rules. You can't ignore rules. And now my children probably don't like this because I won't even drive over the speed limit at this point. But I didn't have an attitude of all these rules are important. I thought they were basically impediments and the ends justified the means. And that's not how life is. And unfortunately, if you live life like that, and I did, you'll wind up in trouble. So that's one big lesson I took away. I also took away the lesson of you better see the forest for the trees or you're going to wind up buried by those trees. And I didn't step back and say, you know, should I have been in this? Should I be doing this? Is there anything wrong with what I'm doing? I never had a moment like that, unfortunately. In fact, as I mentioned, quite the opposite. I thought it was A-OK. So one has to do that in life. In terms of walking the track in prison and what the hell I was treated in prison, I mean, prison is horrible. One day in prison, you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. I was there for 1,299 days, and it's horrible. Unfortunately, America gives a lot of prison time out to people. There are people in prison for a lot longer than I was who were with me, and it's a crushing experience. You're not only taken away from your family, and you're taken away from your freedoms, and you're stripped of everything that you own, and you basically become a number. And you become a slave. You work for 12 cents an hour. You have no privacy. Not 1 minute is a privacy. You're sharing our housing cubicles were 150 square feet, and six men lived in that 150 square feet. It's overcrowded. It's noisy. It's just the most horrible place you could ever be. Every minute I was in prison, I was praying to God to get me out of prison. And thank God, eventually it happened.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org. Or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.